So good morning, everybody. Sorry about yesterday. This means I'll just have to talk twice as fast. Thanks to the ministrations of Dr. Strieber. Are you here, Greg, this morning? He's probably tending someone else. He's hiking? Oh, good for him. So, and Gatorade and Conrad, he's took care of me. We still have an unblemished record. It's not the nasty bug. So today was going to be week in review and starting to talk about what an alternative face of Christianity could be. Like, how can we, I can speak to my own folks as the ELCA, but also the Reformed Church in America. I know we have someone here from there, Presbyterians, Episcopalians, Methodists. How can we be an alternative face of Christianity? And what we're facing is not easy. We've got, on the one hand, the increased secularization of the West. If you've been to Europe lately, have friends or relatives in Europe, you know that church attendance is not great over there. God loves centuries of tradition. They still pay their church tax. So this is great. Whether you go to church or not, you've got to pay the Kirchensteuer in Germany. And I think in Denmark... I don't know about Finland, but certainly in Sweden they do. And in fact, that's how they're able to fund a lot of the relief work that we do as the Lutheran World Federation, because they get its government money. So, doggone revolution. Just think. So that's still going on over there. It's increasingly secular. I had a chance to be over there with the rest of our bishops and spouses. We have, once a year, we have something called a Bishop's Academy. It's continuing education, and we went to Germany. And we were in Erfurt, and there's a huge Roman Catholic church there. It might even be a cathedral. I think it might be a cathedral city. And so we were meeting with their teaching faculty and some of their priests, and they were talking to us, along with the Lutherans, about this new ecumenism that they're really going to engage in. It's like, oh, okay, let's hear how it is. How are you guys doing over here in Western Europe? Well, the new ecumenism, part of it was, if your spouse dies and your spouse is a member of the Catholic Church and you're a member of the Lutheran Church, we'll pray for you and your spouse in the Lutheran Church and vice versa. I mean, it was a step. But now they're moving on. In a lot of places, especially in the north there could be a Catholic Church and a Lutheran Church. So that's pretty much a Lutheran region up in that. But they say if only one church can survive, you know, make sure that whether it's Catholic or Lutheran, we're all going to support one, so there's still one church in the village or one church in the town, that's pretty remarkable. I don't know what that would mean in practice. They didn't explain that to us, if you would have both services in one church or however, but that's an issue for them. And then I was telling them at one point, oh yeah, I had the chance to be to preach at the 300th anniversary of one of our congregations on the mainland. Now Frederick's Lutheran Church on St. Thomas is 350 years old. That's our oldest congregation. I think it beats the one in New York City, though they have a big rivalry going back and forth. And they said 300 years. Like, that's nothing over here. So they've got these huge, in some cases, huge, huge structures. And what are they going to do? And talk about deferred maintenance. It's just been, could be centuries. And they're not heated in a lot of cases. Or it's like the church, like where my grandfather's church is, there's the church, but then the any sort of fellowship hall and facilities are completely separate from there. So you've got that problem. So they're dealing with that, delayed maintenance, huge, huge buildings, which they don't try to heat. I think that's smart. That's all part of what they have and the secularization. And we're seeing that over here as well. I think the fastest growing religious category, according to the Pew, who are these Pew people? I want to meet them one day. It's the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, and that seems to be growing. So that's something that we're facing here as well. And my dear brother and sister Lutherans, though this probably applies to other mainline denominations as well, we're like 20 years older than the average population in the United States. And you probably recognize this when you're in your congregations. Okay, so that's one thing that we're seeing, that church does not have the privileged position that it had in our society for years, well, since the end of the Second World War. Now, you go back to frontier America, and even the first, 1700s, 1800s, church attendance was not great. So this myth that we're a great church-going nation is just not true. It was pretty wild on the frontier, and it was not exactly people marching to church in the cities in the 17th and the 1800s. We did see a huge uptick in church attendance and participation after the Second World War as the Cold War really got underway. I'm young enough to remember President Eisenhower coming on with public service announcements saying, attend the church or synagogue of your choice. Do you remember those things? Yeah. And it was then, because it was the godless communists, and we were going to show that we were not the godless communists, that it was a bankrupt ideology that they had. And I think people did have a sense that they needed to be in church, and not just to show that they're real Americans, but also there was a spiritual component. But it was a lot easier to be in church, I think, or a synagogue on the weekends, because first of all, everything was closed, There were no soccer leagues on Sundays, at least. There was some soccer in this country, though real Americans play football. But, that was not going to happen on Sunday. Stores were closed. I tried to tell this to my kids, and it's like, no, that can't possibly be. Well, who cares if they're closed? Just go on Amazon, and you're all set. I said, no. No, they know better than that. They're older now. So that was a reality. The words, one nation under God, were added to the Pledge of Allegiance during this time. In God we trust was put in our money, and the God and Country Award for the Boy Scouts was added. And I think it came a little later for the Girl Scouts, or whatever ours was. I was a Girl Scout, okay. I had the Order of the Arrow and the Order of the Star. Just saying, okay. Yeah, because I'm one of those insufferable nerds. Let's just be clear about that, so... So that was all going on then, and that was a huge uptick in participation in our churches. And still, for, I'd say, the Lutheran movement, we still at that time had some semblance or held on somewhat to our ethnic roots. The Lutherans have an interesting history in the United States, and I won't go through that whole business. But we came over here in sort of ethnic waves and stayed in our ethnic communities and kept our language. And Lutheran theology is different than Reformed or deist understandings of God or of the church. And so we were able to maintain our Lutheran understanding of the gospel and a Lutheran theology because we were in our little ethnic, and people were suspicious of us. I mean, we know all the stories at World War I, when people would change the names of their churches or their entire towns. Where this church is, this one in New Jersey, it had been Germantown, and now I think it's Oldwick, New Jersey, but they changed at World War I. So we were looked on with suspicion, and what are they doing in there? They're not really Catholic, but there's a lot of standing up and sitting down going on in there. I don't know. I know one person joined my first congregation where I was the assistant, and she goes, what's with you Lutherans? You're up and down. You're like toast, up and down. So we managed that, and still, I know from my mother's side, my mother's people, they came over, my grandfather came over right after the First World War, my grandmother came over at the beginning of the 20th century, and still, my grandfather's second language, well, third or fourth, was always English. He spoke with a heavy accent. He spoke, we had to speak Saxon, that was our dialect, and then German for church, and then they had to speak Romanian because the Romanians, we were in a part of what was called Romania, the Carpathian Mountains, and then he had to speak Hungarian because that was the empire's language, and then he also somehow learned Italian and could swear in all of these languages, which is amazing. So still then in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, they were still, and the Sachsenheim, I still get the Volksblatt, which is it's mostly in English now, thank goodness, but it's a newspaper for the Siebenbürgen Sachsische Leute, the Siebenbürgen Saxon people. And we still have our Volksblatt, and we still have our Sachsenheim, and Adolf makes a sausage twice a year, November and February, got to get your order in. But we were part of all those sorts of things, and we could be preserved. But that's all shifted now. Not completely, because still, how many of you are Norwegian or claim Norwegian ancestry? Yeah, there are a lot of you out here. So I didn't know about Norwegians. Pardon me? Well, Swedes I knew about. I served a Swedish congregation. My last one was an Augustana congregation. They were wonderful, but they had this Santa Lucia thing. I was like, what's that? Because I didn't grow up with any of that influence. You go further east, and they're Swedes, but they're more Germans, and we didn't know anything about Norwegians. So, but that's, we still have that, but that's sort of dissolving. So there's a secularization that's happening. Our kids might not identify strongly with whatever our ethnic roots happen to be, or they're not going to church. And then to compound that, tell me what you think, and I bet you're going to be right. Who does the news media turn to when they want a story on religion? The evangelicals and the Catholics, absolutely. You know, we're trying to get them to turn to me. But I say it's a whole strategy. I have been on NPR, so I'm like, whoa. And I try not to get all fangirly. Oh, Tom Jelton, whoa, whoa. But I didn't. But that's the truth. And that somehow then becomes the face of Christianity, particularly now, I would say, that not our kind of evangelicalism, but evangelical Christians, as they're just self-defined, are the ones that are most likely quoted, or the ones in popular culture who are seen as the face of Christianity. So when people are asked about why don't you go to church, they say because church is judgmental, church is anti-gay, church is anti-intellectual, church is anti-science. They're a bunch of hypocrites. I used to say that to people, you bet we are. That's why we need church. We got a pew for every kind of hypocrisy. Come on in. They're too concerned about rules and laws and that sort of stuff. And that, why would you want to be a part of that? So that's another thing that compounds this. Twice... Once for each, evangelical was a plus the way they thought it was, and living in a really, really Roman Catholic town was a plus. Evangelical, so we've had, through one of your colleagues at the churchwide office, a 10-year relationship with folks in Iran, where their clerics and their leading scholars come with us in the United States. So it's Muslims, Shia Muslims, Christians, Jews talking about these issues of the Abrahamic faith, what we share to try to find a way toward peace. Okay, so we're now part of that crew, and so then the Iranian ambassador to the United Nations convened a group of evangelicals. So I got invited. It's like, okay. I mean, these are the folks like do the national prayer breakfast thing, and they're advisors to the president. I don't think he listens to their advice very much, but he's advisors to him and all these leading evangelicals. They get to me, and I said, we might understand evangelical a little bit different than you do, but I got to come to dinner, so it was like a great plus for me. That was good. And then Chicago is an extremely Roman Catholic town, very, very Roman Catholic town. And so I'm dressed in all of my bishop clothes with my pectoral cross and the whole thing because I'm going to the airport to fly to Minneapolis to install the new president, or whatever you do with the presidents of seminaries, Robin Steinke. And as I mentioned before, sometimes I drive a little more rapidly than I ought. So I'm getting there to the airport. You know, there's no cars there. I'm going, sure enough, a cop pulls me over. It's like, oh, geez. He pulls me over and he looks at me. He's like, sister, you got to slow down. I said, oh, yes, officer. Yes, yes, I do, officer. You're quite correct. He goes, pray for me, sister. I said, oh, I am. I'm praying for you. He let me go. So that was two times. So it worked. Yeah. Now I watch it around that particular area. I mean, I should be good all the way around, but not always. Okay, so now here we are then in an increasingly, at one hand, an increasingly secular society, and on the other hand, a society that sees mostly evangelicalism. The Pope gets some props, though he's not real popular amongst a lot of people. He does not live in the Vatican Palace. He lives in Domus Santa Marta, St. Martha's, of course, because they're busy and cleaning and cooking supper, because if it were St. Mary's, those folks would never get anything to eat, so that's where he lives over there. So he's doing some amazing stuff. I don't agree with all all of his stuff that he says, but he's going the right way. But that gave kind of a bump, I think, to when he was first, whatever you do when you're Pope. Elected, yeah, because they don't like consecrate them. He's already a bishop. Okay, so but it's evangelicalism and this just judgmental, anti-everything. So how do we then, as the Lutheran movement, but also other mainline Protestants, how do we present an alternative face of Christianity, and what would that be? So I don't have all the answers, so don't get excited and take notes. And I don't know how to grow our small congregations. I've been thinking about that last night as well. Well, I think about that all the time. But one thing is, when we've been talking about fear and the bad kind of fear, but I think that there's still a lot of fear-based religion. And I'm not going to lay that all on fundamentalists. I think sometimes we get into this too. Have I done enough? And that was Luther's question when he was in the monastery. And even before then, have I done enough? And he would always go to confession and confess and confess and confess and then leave and come back. Can you imagine being his confessor? It's like, oh, geez. You take confessional number 3. He's coming there. I'm not taking that today. But he really was consumed. He took seriously this notion that God was a God of wrath and judgment, and God does judge. That's true. But there was no relief from that judgment. We understand, and Luther was able to articulate that understanding clearly, that in fact God does judge us and find us wanting, that we have fallen short, but God has sent Jesus then to reconcile us, so that work's been done. But he didn't get that. And it really, the mantra was in medieval Christianity is do what is in you. You had to work as hard as you could because then you could fan the flames of this latent ember of holiness or righteousness, and then maybe you could spend less time in purgatory. So can you imagine that kind of burden all of the time? All of the time? And Luther, he was probably one of those insufferable nerds too, as well as being a genius and really kind of an intense guy. I'm glad he lightened up later on. I think that was Katie's influence, because, man, he was, whew. He would be driven to distraction. And we're pretty sure he did, he damaged his health in his attempt to mortify the flesh. So he'd sleep on the stone floor. I've been to that place in Wittenberg. Brr. You know, it's not like this. And then he'd fast. And then, sadly, and he writes about it, well, he developed all kinds of intestinal problems because of that. But he was just determined to do this, but every time he would engage in this and think he'd got it, he realized he had not done enough. And that's that fear-based, part of the fear-based religion, and that still gnaws and nags at us, I think. We don't believe grace really is too good to be true, except for that it is, okay? So when Luther then finally discovered that it's God's work that has been done for us, and it's not up to us to save ourselves, you can imagine the relief he must have felt. And you imagine the relief of all of his brothers in the monastery. It's like, oh, great. He's better. So, but that's still a reality, and I think that's still there in a lot of our culture. And I would still say in some aspects and facets of evangelical fundamentalism that it's possible, in fact, it's necessary for ourselves to work ourselves into a right relationship with God. And this still happens, I would contend, on the religious left as well as on the religious right. Now, the religious right, it's a set of moral indicators that you have to, or values you have to make sure you can check off. So it's about behavior. And I remember when we were kids, a couple of times we drove down from Cleveland, Ohio to Florida, and my dad would drive. And I don't know if you had dads like this, so we'd be driving and driving. You got to leave when the stars are still out in the sky. You don't drive like that. He'd be going really fast, and mom say, Bill, the kids need a break. Okay, we're making great time. Did you have a dad who would do that? Oh, you remember that? Sorry. So we're going through the Smoky Mountains, and, hairpin turns, and there are these billboards that say things like prepare to meet God, and would be in the back seat. No, Daddy, we don't want to meet God. Slow down. Whatever. He's driving. But there was one there, I still remember, it says there's no drinking, no dancing, no swearing, no card playing, no movie going. There's no sin within 7 miles of our church. I mean, why seven? I mean, I didn't understand. But it's like, well, then what? There's no people within 7 miles of your church. But those sort of external things, if you could check those off, then you're probably going to be okay. You're in the straight and narrow. And your former director for research and evaluation at the Churchwide Center grew up in a household like that. And the sense was, you'd be okay, but there was always the possibility that you could miss one of those. And then you were in big trouble. So he grew up in this fear-based faith, and it was only when he was in college that he started to read about Luther and Lutheran's understanding of justification and grace, which is actually God's understanding, that he thought, I don't have to live like this, always looking over my shoulder. So that he became Lutheran. So that's one side when we take a look at that. But then I'll be myself as part of the liberal camp. We liberals have our own works righteousness that we do. Because if we have enough protests, if we have enough boycotts, if we write enough letters to Congress, I got this terrible feeling. One day I will be allowed a tour through the White House, and there in some intern's desk will be all the letters I've written the president. If we do that, then somehow we, and it's our duty, can change the world, that we can bring about a reconciled world. We saw this was a big movement at the in the beginning of the 20th century, 1800s and 1900s. Rauthenbusch was this sort of social gospel, and the idea was that we could become better and better and better until we could have this redeemed and good world. No, it's not going to work. It's in us. I think in Alcoholics Anonymous, they call it the geographic cure. Did I just leave where I am now because they're bad influences, I'll be fine. But no, it's in you. So that's something. And for me, the emporium of this works righteousness and escape from the tragic fallenness of the rest of the world is Whole Foods. Do you have that out here? Yeah, Whole Foods, Whole Paycheck, I think you call it something. Yeah. Yes. You can go to Whole Foods and you can buy veal without guilt, right? You know, it's this whole thing. Something has to die so that we can live. But no, you can buy veal without guilt, because the notion is that the little calf, after gambling over the hills, turns itself into the butcher, who is wearing probably, you know, all natural fabrics. And just quoting Dickens, says to the butcher, "It's a far, far better thing I do than I've ever done before." And so it's like, you know, guilt-free. No, we're stuck in this too. And this insidious, I think, for folks maybe on the liberal side, thinking that there is, that grace is not enough, that we have to add our own. That's also in some ways not as obviously fear-based, but still, we know the world's in a world of hurt. We know that. And so we really have to work hard to fix it. No, that's been done. So here in Isaiah 43, when the people were deep in questioning, trying to understand what had happened to them, had we not done enough, does God love us? When God pronounces or announces to them, not only fear not, but that you're precious and I love you, this is this word of grace, but also telling them, I, God, have done this work. It's not up to you. I've done it. So, I was looking around. I can't get on my, everything's in the cloud, right? Even something that I've typed in, and I don't know what the cloud is, but it's got it, and I can't get to it from here, so. But I think I remember. But anyways, it's a quote from Tim Wangert, who used to be a Reformation Studies professor. He's retired now it was Philadelphia Seminary. Now it's United Lutheran Seminary. And he said to us as the church, this is a question we have to answer. Since God in God's love has reconciled the world to God's self, since it's not up to us, since everything has been done for us, what do we do now that we don't have to do anything? I'll listen to your answers here. And not in the sense that, you know, the seventh grade idea, you can see the little light bulb. when you're going over a grace, and you say, no, God loves you, forgiveness, it's not up to you, that God will forgive you. And you think that you could see him going, I can do anything I want. You know, not that kind of, now that we won't have to do anything. But how could we be, and how are we the church, now that we don't have to worry about our salvation all of the time? Now that we know that we're not good enough, but God has taken care of that, what do we do now that we don't have to do anything? Listenings and conversations, and we can do that maybe not entirely without fear, but with a little less fear, because we're not going to die from it. And we can see the other. And also inviting people and serving other people. That's, if you want, it's relatively short for some stuff that Luther would write, but anyways, it's where Luther talks about, now that we've been freed in Christ, we're freed in Christ to serve the neighbor. Help me, pastors. Freedom of the Christian. Thank you. Freedom of the Christian. So I think that's worth reading. And in that, Luther makes the parrot. Thanks for back there. And I left my suitcase in the lobby. Thanks, honey. Sorry. I have to be out by 10. So that he makes this amazing, again, Lutheran paradox statement that we are free and Lord of all, or Lady of all, depending how you want to. That's true. That's absolutely true. We don't have to worry about that. But then Luther would say, because we're free, we're also completely bound and servant to everyone else. So in our freedom, we're free to serve the neighbor. And without looking at the neighbor as an object, so if we're doing our God's work, our hands stuff out there, and then if we serve those people, they're not because they're beautiful people and we're free, might be part of it, but it's like, if I serve them, then I'll get a certain amount of brownie points, which will make it possible for me to go to heaven, right? Think of what that does. So if I'm serving you only because I can get something out of serving you, I'm not looking at you as a sister or someone who is made in God's image. And that's a different way of looking at service and looking at people. We're not using them for our own gain, even if it's when you do it that way, you're perpetrating good works on unsuspecting natives. That's not good. So that's one freedom that we have. Another freedom that we have, I would say, if we're understanding that we've now been set free, that we're not a fear-based relationship with God, is that we're free, as you're hearing from some of our faculty, to engage in an actual conversation and also relationship and encounter, more than an encounter, with people who have completely different understandings of the world, of politics, of religion than we do. The ELCA is working on, and we're still in the draft process, a declaration of interreligious commitment. We have one on ecumenical commitment that we adopted, really early on in the 90s, which was based on work that we'd done in our predecessor bodies, but also the sense that, Jesus doesn't want about a million Christian denominations. Actually, there aren't a million, there are about 40,000. But he does want that. So how can we retain and be clear about who we are, but then also secure in understanding that, be able to listen to how God is operating and acting in other Christian denominations. So we have 6 full communion partners right now. The Episcopalians, yay! The Methodists, the Reformed Church in America, the United Church of Christ, the Presbyterian Church USA, and the Moravians. So we can interchange clergy, one of the beauties for us for ecumenical relations in the Lutheran movement is that Melanchthon wrote it, but the Augsburg Confession, number 7, Article 7, he says, it is enough for church unity that the gospel is preached in its purity and the sacraments are administered according to the gospel. So that's pretty basic. We don't worry about, what a rotchet and a shamir is. I couldn't spell it anyways, but that's what their bishops wear when they're not presiding, right, honey? It's like sort of like a prayer. They do? We've been married for 34 years and I didn't know that. Yes, of course. So we'd have to worry about different liturgical practices. They don't have to worry that we don't wear that stuff. We don't have to worry that they have, like the Methodists have their book of discipline or whatever. We recognize that the gospel's being preached and the sacraments are being administered. So that's one thing. But in that statement was embedded, it was like ready for a sequel, like at the end of Master and Commander, you know, when the bad guy's ship gets away at the end, that we've not had the sequel, it's been 10 years later, so maybe we won't. Anyways, that we probably would need some statement on interreligious relationships, because all of us, my guess is, all of us live in an interreligious context. When we go back to our last parishes that we served were in Ashtabula, Ohio. And some of you heard of Ashtabula. Yay. Most people drive through it on I-90, but it's a small city. And we're considered, even though we're far from the Appalachians, an Appalachian, part of the Appalachian catchment there. And it's not the most progressive place in the world, but the synagogue was next to my church, and we would have doctors from Pakistan, and their kids would be Muslim. And so even in that small town, we had all kinds of religious traditions. I don't know, do we have some Hindus? I don't remember. Like Nagaprakash and Raghupathy, were they? Nag and Rag, they were Muslim. They were the pediatricians, and we couldn't say their names. We called them Nag and Rag. It was easier. Nagaprakash and Raghupathy, they like that. But that's true, and our children are going, probably, my guess is, some of us have already, if they've not married out of sight of the Lutheran fold, like marrying an Episcopalian. Yeah. For my grandfather, he wasn't a Saxon, that's the hard part, but once he got past that, he was a big promoter of this. Sit next to your boyfriend. Grandpa, he's just a friend. No, sit next to your boyfriend. He was right. So anyways, because we have a sense of us, and we're not based on a fear-based way of looking at the world, we can engage in these conversations. And let me see here. Here we are. And so one of the things we're talking about when we're engaging in this statement is that because we have an appreciation of our own Christian faith, of the Lutheran movement in the Christian faith, understanding can be more than just tolerance. Understanding, as used here, is a process of moving from factual knowledge of commonalities and differences to grasping coherence and even glimpsing beauty, sensing how it is that others love and cherish their religious traditions. If we're not a fear-based church movement, if we're not so concerned that we'll somehow lose ourselves, and this is attack on our own beliefs, if we are convinced or can live securely in the sense that God has taken care of this and that we're justified by grace through faith, and not giving any of that up, not giving up Jesus, it's possible then not to see other religious traditions as a threat, but also see that there's some beauty in that and that they love and cherish their traditions and we can learn from them. That's an alternative face of Christianity. And I think right now the ELCA for sure, and I'm sure other denominations represented here are also engaged in this. We're doing a lot of work with the Muslim community and also with the Jewish community. We reach out to Sikhs and Hindus in some ways, but particularly those two because they're under enormous stress right now. The anti-Muslim hysteria, or at least prejudice that's being, I don't know, maybe it's not being, maybe it's always been there, but we weren't allowed to talk about it, or people didn't realize there were as many Muslims, but it's terrible right now. And that's just, as Lutherans, we would say, you know, part of, commandment number 5 was always like the no-brainer. Who said that early on? Nadia, the first night? The no-brainer, okay. But you're supposed to do whatever you can to help your neighbor. And then for the eighth commandment, we number ours different, everybody else who are not Lutherans do this. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You can check it out if you want, any time, and you've got the cranberry hymnal, the small catechism is in the back, so if the sermon's not doing it for you, just check that out. But it's not just about speaking ill of your neighbor. Don't do that. You're supposed to speak well and explain his or her actions in the best possible way. So understanding love for neighbor, that's part of how the commandments and how we understand that. That means we have love and concern for our neighbors who are of other religious traditions or no religious tradition, which would be, an alternative face of Christianity. We don't write those people off and say God has no concern for them. As happened when I was in I'm yakking at you again. When I was in a parish back in Ashtabula, and what is it like, the National Prayer Day? Is it? It comes around once a year, the National Day of Prayer. So we had a big thing in our public square, and I was, you know, asked to be a part of it. And the guy before me, I got to give the benediction. So he's going on. He says, God does not hear the prayers of those who aren't Christians. And he meant a particular kind of Christians. And this is, and he's going, this is a public thing going on here. It's like, great. So I got up and I said, okay, first of all, we are all created in God's image, and everyone is a beloved child of God. I said, second of all, I'm going to give you this benediction that, you know, we once, that, you know, Aaron gave, but it was part of the Abrahamic tradition. And let's be clear that God made a covenant with Ishmael before he did with Isaac. Now let's hear the benediction, which was not very good, you know. It's just not fair to use the pulpit that way. But I was pretty steamed, and that was actually, and I think that that's not absent in a lot of places. In our colleges and universities, Lutheran colleges and universities, there is a great attention to helping not just Lutherans, but all of the students understand that we live in a religiously plural world, and some people have plural religious identities or understandings. They might say, well, there's a lot about Buddhism that I find compelling, so I'll call myself, I'm a Lutheran, but I'll be a Lubu. That's their words. So the Lutheran and they blend that together. And then we're in our workplaces, in the classroom, this is an interreligious setting. How then do we help our future leaders, citizens, learn to live, navigate, and thrive, and also not just tolerate, but understand and appreciate those with a different religious tradition? And let me tell you, some of the older alums are not happy. Why are we not turning not just the Hindus and the Muslims and the Jews, but everybody else into Lutherans in these colleges? That's really what we should be doing. And we say, no, that's we don't have to do that. But then at the same time, we can be very clear about how we understand God working in Jesus Christ, and we don't have to make excuses for that. If you know that, and I think when I talked a little bit about a well-differentiated self, when we're talking about anxiety and fear, that you sort of lose all that. So we can be well-differentiated in the way that we understand God and Jesus Christ. And we can be very clear in saying to other people, in witnessing to other people, that we find that this is the beautiful way that God is present in the world for everyone, not just for Lutherans or Christians. And at the same time, then have an actual encounter with someone from another tradition. Because I found that Notre Dame never apologized for being a Roman Catholic institution. For a long time, our colleges and universities were trying to downplay the Lutheran connection. Now they're up. They think it's a good thing. And Daryl Jodock, once you get available to the cloud and whatever that is out in the world, Daryl Jodock, J-O-D-D-O-C-K, he has written a good argument or compelling presentation of how Lutheran is value-added in colleges and universities. It's the third way. And another part of us being an alternative face of Christianity. He says Lutherans have this notion that of grace also means that we cannot define or limit or determine how far God's grace extends. So it's not just for us. And it might mysteriously, God can, and God's power can be making grace available to other people. Remember, Cyrus the Persian was going to be the one bringing rescue to these people and call the Messiah. He was a pagan. So grace extends further than we think. Love of neighbor and serving the neighbor is a Lutheran tradition. Wherever the neighbor is, without condition, without saying, well, you convert first and then maybe I'll help you fix your house. No, we don't do that. An intellectual inquiry. Luther was a university professor. So that has always been a part of who we are, which is would be, we don't want to close down science. I was at my college a year ago spring, and I was explaining, it was the College of Worcester in Worcester, Ohio. Yeah, no one's heard of that either. It's a nice school, Presbyterian school. But it was Religio et Scientio ex uno fonte. So religion and science from one fount. And I was trying to explain to people that that's possible. And that's, we understand that in our church. We are not afraid of scientific inquiry or other academic or intellectual endeavors. That's being an alternative face of Christianity. We're not threatened by that. We embrace that. They were stunned because they thought that all religious people hated learning, but no, okay. We might hate homework, but we don't hate learning, so. Okay, so let me see here. And then, yes, when we then serve the neighbor, and we do it in very, I think, powerful ways as the ELCA, but also other denominations as well, we don't depend on them. We don't say first, as I said before, you've got to convert before we'll serve you. We find people where they are, and we listen to what their needs are, and then we work with them. So, for example, people from time to time say, should we just drop Lutheran from the name because that's too limiting or whatever. No one knows what that is or it's off-putting. Well, no. Kirby Untai, who's the bishop in our bishop in Northwest Washington Synod, as he calls it, the other planet, the Pacific Northwest. It's like, come on, Kirby. You know, their church is there. I've seen them. Been in them, so. But he would say, he said, don't drop Lutheran. He says, when people are looking for social services and they're not Christian, they say, just where's Lutheran? Because I know about that. And then when I had a chance to be in the Zaatari refugee camp in Jordan, we work with the United Nations. There's a whole place called the Peace Oasis in there. And everyone knows what Lutheran is because they can go there and they can get tutoring for their kids. They can learn, sadly, another trade now that once they'll be out. They have a chance just to relax and be at peace. They know what Lutheran is, and we serve those people. Of course, we serve them in the name of Jesus, but we're not going to say, oh, you're Muslim, too bad. And we'll partner with other people of goodwill. So we have have had a long-time relationship with the Islamic Relief. And in 2016, outside of Lund, Sweden, the Lutheran World Federation and the Vatican together signed a pact saying we're going to work together on relief issues, and we're going to work with as we can with other people of goodwill. So this, I think, can be an alternative, an expansive understanding, a liberated understanding of what it means to be the church, a freedom that's there, a freedom to serve the neighbor, not as an object, but as a brother or sister, the excitement of being able to explore God's creation and not be threatened to their faith. I mean, think about this. Who knows? They found a lake on Mars. We'll see what happens. What happens if we do find life on another planet? How does that rearrange our thinking? But we would say it doesn't matter because God has acted this way for us and for creation. We can be brave enough to have our faith challenged or looked at like that. So I don't know how that's going to grow the congregations in rural Iowa or southwest Minnesota. But maybe if we're going to go down, let's go down swinging or serving. That would be better. Metaphor. Yeah. So now I have really talked at you a long time. There's time now. And we have a microphone. Here's a question right behind you, Sharon.
Can you tell me what an evangelical looks like?
I'm looking at a room full of them.
What define being evangelical?
Okay.
Is it so far right it's out of sight? Or
No, I'm trying to reclaim the E word. Evangelical, as you know, Pastor, and all of you took Greek, comes from the Greek word evangelion, which means the good news. And when a true evangelical, I would say, is someone who proclaims the good news, which is that we have been justified by grace through faith, that it's not up to us, it's God's doing and not ours, and now we are free. That's an evangelical witness. And we need to be able to say that right out. I mean, we might not beat the sort of cultural wave on this, but we are that is it. How do we proclaim the good news in word and deed? Where to be good. You know, people take a little too serious St. Francis, once his admonition, always preach the gospel, use words if necessary. No, we better start using words and naming the name. But that's evangelical. The good news of Jesus Christ, which is that we are saved and set free for service because of God's work and not because of us trying to work our way into heaven. That's evangelical. That's us. Put on a t-shirt. That's evangelical. That's us. It's coming. Here comes the microphone. It just helps. It's hard to hear on the outside.
So I'm curious about that word in terms of our church and when we adopted that term, because I think evangelical denotes more of the prosperity ministry, the, you know, really out there right wing. And I wonder if it's off-putting to some people that are looking for the Lutheran Church. I mean, I came from a tradition of, I think we were LCA or ALC, mm-hmm. you know, and then all of a sudden we're evangelical, and it's like, well, I am. So I love your definition, mm-hmm. but I wonder if there is ever a point where it could be off-putting to some, that, if they don't understand.
Can you all, did you all hear that? Hooray for the microphone. Yeah, that's a question that goes on and on. When the Lutheran movement started, it was never called Lutheran. And Luther said, far be it that the beautiful children of Christ should be named after the stinking, rotting bag of worms. He liked that kind of talk. In a lot of places in the world, the church is not called Lutheran. It's the Evangelische or the Evangelical Church. And they might say of the Augsburg Confession or whatever. So that's still in some places. Here, you know, we're not evangelical maybe in that sense. But we're not evangelical that we're getting the word out either, that we're telling people about the good news and that there is this alternative face to Christianity. And this is true evangelism. Maybe we're fighting an uphill battle on that, and we do take a look at that. One thought, for a possibility for a name when the church came together, was the Evangelical Catholic Church in America. And I was like, oh, no, that's going to confuse everybody right there. Catholic with a small C. That's a good question. How does, you know, we clinging to our ethnic heritage, and that Lutheran somehow then becomes, you have to be Norwegian or Saxon or Swedish or whatever, and does that prevent people from even considering being a part of this because they're not, or is it a way to promote white supremacy? There is a concern, and I've written about this several times, and there's a group called Decolonized Lutheranism, though there's some... I like them all, but there's some issues with that. They haven't faced real colonization, and one of our Alaska Native people brought it out to them. But anyways, we cannot say that Lutheranism has specifically or even anything to do with cuisine or culture. You know, just like in the first century, we decided you didn't have to be Jewish in order to be Christian. You don't have to be Norwegian or a particular Northern European ethnic group in order to become Lutheran. And that is an impediment for folks trying then to be members of our congregations, fully members. So how do we honor that history but not make that part of what it means to be exclusively what it means to be a Lutheran? And that's a problem. That's one reason why I think we're still the whitest denomination in the United States, because we are saying, you know, grace is for everyone, but you better, you know, do it this way. That's an issue. We are growing in our Latina missions, and they're not going to be Norwegians, those folks. So how then are they seen as fully Lutheran with their own flavor, accent, or whatever, but that we share our theology? That's what we share. Well, we share Jesus, or Jesus shares us. That has to be central. Our ethnic heritage, particularly those of us who came over from Europe, that can get in the way of other people realizing and participating in a community that is set free by God's grace. So, yeah, that's a good point. Yes, please. Here comes a microphone's going back here and then up here. Sharon, when you're done there, there's one up here. Yes.
Could you say a few words about the state of our seminaries today and the recruitment of pastors?
Didn't we serve together in Youngstown? A long time ago. I was in Boardman and you were in Youngstown. Were you also in Boardman? John's a Finn. That's right. The state of our seminaries today, well... Oh, my gosh. Well, John, they're in flux, and I'm not sure how it's going to end up. The dean of my divinity school, who was a Lutheran, would always, the first-year students, all the juniors would be in the room, and he'd say, you know, the church needs a learned clergy. And I would say that the Lutheran way of telling the Jesus story does take some education. You better know the scriptures, and you better know the confessions, and you better know something about church history in order to tell that story here now. So we have seminaries, and we're finding now that traditions that did not require seminary education now are turning to our seminaries and others so that their folks get an MDiv. So the historic black churches work a lot with our seminaries, because if you want to be a bishop, you better have an MDiv. So there's a recognition there. So we have seminaries. The way theological education in a lot of ways started in this country for everybody was you were a department within a university. But then we started building freestanding seminaries. And that was a tradition for a couple hundred years, or 100 years, 150 years maybe, where these freestanding seminaries. We used to have eight. Well, we used to have a lot more when we were ALC and the LCA and in this history of combining. We have seven now because two combined. So Gettysburg in that part of Pennsylvania and Philadelphia have said we're going to work together, and they're the United Lutheran Seminary, which is interesting because, like a lot of congregations, Philadelphia was founded after a nasty church split with the people of the seminary in Gettysburg. So it's good that they're coming together. Three of our seminaries are now, once again, part of universities. So Pacific Lutheran Theological School is part of Cal Lutheran. Southern Seminary is part of Lenoir Rhine, which makes Newberry angry because Newberry's in the same state, and Lenoir, they jumped us, never mind. And then Trinity now is part of Capital University. And so we have Wartburg, Luther, and Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago are still sort of the freestanding ones. 5 years ago at least, maybe six before I came on, the church said we need to take a look at all of theological education across the church, not just the seminaries, but really the seminaries. We have to look at this. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to have at that time eight seminary presidents for 1,500 students. And we see that there's a decline, that those of us, Johns, and my age and older, we're going to be retiring soon. And people are not deciding to say yes to a call to public ministry as a pastor or a deacon in the numbers that they once did. So we're looking at that. So decreasing student population. Students come in with enormous undergraduate student debt, which is really difficult. So what can we do, we said, in TEEC, Theological Education Advisory Council, and Marcus's dad, John, is the chair of this right now, and take a look at how all of us should be engaged in lifelong learning, but let's look at the seminaries. So we did this whole big audit of the seminaries, how much buildings they have, how much unused space, what the expenditures were, how many students, the whole thing, and made this very starkly clear, what we all suspected, is that we're losing millions of dollars a year in a very inefficient system. And so it was proposed that we take a look at how can we then have the seminaries at least share some of the operations, maybe some of the back office stuff, maybe take a look at one application for everybody and then divide that up. How do you share professors? How, now that we're able to do distributive learning or distance learning, how do we share faculty? Okay, yeah, we should do that, they said. Well, then they didn't. So then we said, okay. So then I invited the seminary board presidents, board chairs, to come for a meeting. And they came, they're all there, and I said, this is not working. And the guy who was the chair of the board of Luther said, we've got to take a bold step. We can't fool around anymore. And the guy from PLTS says, you're exactly right. We can't just tweak it. Let's take a bold step and say we're going to have one seminary, and maybe it'll be in eight places. But somehow we're going to do something cooperatively. Yes! No, that didn't happen. Okay. And then the Conference of Bishops said, we need something that will look like one seminary in eight places just so there can be a better economy of scale, that there can be more cooperation. It's not working. And yes, and no, that didn't happen either. And so then we had the combination of ULS, those two schools, and then three schools trying to find their way into universities and three left. They were supposed to work together. Well, now we've got Wartburg has come up with, I think, a clever or a good plan where you can have a 3+3, so 3 years of undergraduate work and then 3 years of seminary as opposed to 7 years to get yourself through to be ordained. And they're working with Wartburg College. But they did that, and they informed the other two seminaries, the other six seminaries. But now they're doing that by themselves. Now Luther, and I was helping with this, Luther now has devised this two-year MDiv, where you start day one in a parish, I think this is a good idea, and you go straight through without any breaks, and you get your theological education by distributive learning, distance learning, but also on site, but also have actual practical learning while you're doing that. But now they've done that, and how is that going to work for the rest of the seminary situation? The thought is right now that the experiments that are happening in different places, the ULS experiment, Luther trying this, Wartburg trying that, that maybe that will be a pilot or something that could be used across the seminary system. But I mean, I love these people who are our seminary leaders. It's a difficult job right now. But doggone it, I don't think it's going to be Darwinian maybe in the end. And the other thing is, how are we, you're the ones that can really help, how do you identify, raise up, and support people who you see have gifts for ministry? It used to be that congregations would do that on a regular basis. I have heard, because it was way before my time, that sometimes seminarians wouldn't have to pay a dime for their seminary education because their congregations would do that for them. Well, that wasn't happening for me. As a girl, and didn't go to a Lutheran school, but I'm Lutheran. We do work, we have something called Fund for Leaders, and that's a scholarship program we have through the ELCA, part of the campaign for the ELCA, and we're trying to get to the point where every seminarian has full tuition paid. Luther's moving toward that, I think ULS is, though they depend on our scholarships. But then how do we get to that point where there's not additional debt? So the scholarship, the tuition is not the major expense. It's living expenses and books and all that kind of stuff. So this has to be a church-wide endeavor where we recognize, identify, and support people who are called to public ministry, and then we've got to somehow see if we can get these schools to work together. But this one donor said, well, just tell them. And, oh, okay. How didn't I think of that? Just tell them. Okay. They're all separately incorporated. Well, except for now, the ones that are now in colleges, universities. We've got the wackiest governance structure in the world. Someone, our bishop in New York, in Washington, said, when we came together as the ELCA, we trusted the Holy Spirit and nobody else. So, dirty little secret, I have almost no power or governance authority to tell anything to colleges and universities, to telling them to synods, to seminaries, to congregations. So we have this odd structure. So how, using that, and God can bring good out of not so good, how do we then work together? So it's I don't know how it's going to work out, John. It's a little scary right now. So, yes, please, do we have a microphone? Or did someone have a question up here? You did, okay. She was waiting like for two people ago. And if you have your suitcases set, you don't have to worry. Okay, go ahead, because we're going after 10.
This is a concern for a parent, grandparent, so it's off the seminary issue.
Okay.
But we have children, grandchildren, et cetera, where we see baptism not being part of their whatever. What do we do? How do we, as concern Christian grandparents and great-grandparents see to their education, to their development, and to the sacraments as part of their life?
That's got to be really, because you have to deal with your child and your child-in-law in that one. That's dicey right there. Do they come to visit you ever, the grandkids?
Say it again.
Do your grandchildren ever come to visit you?
Sometimes, but not the ones that need it.
Oh. Are they afraid you're going to haul them off to church and that's why they won't bring the kids around? Man, I keep praying about that one. You can't force people to be baptized.
I want to say one more thing.
And then it's, I don't know. I know in East Germany, when there was an East Germany, there was this whole middle generation that was absent. But in a lot of cases, the children then would spend a lot of time with their grandparents, and their grandparents would send them to church camp. So that way, that kept the faith going there. That's a tough one. I don't know.
We're thinking of resorting to the kitchen sink.
Well, that's interesting. Though, I had this couple. She was Lutheran Christian. He was a Reformed Jew. And so they raise the kids, and they come back and forth between the synagogue and our church. And it came time for First Communion. And so they wanted to have their oldest, you know, their older daughter go. She was that age. Fine, okay. So we're talking about this. I said, to start this off, go home and ask your parents about your baptism and why they did blah, blah, blah. And she goes home. The kid said, well, I'm Jewish. I'm not baptized. And then the mom came to me and said, well, when she was really little, she was really sick, and she was in the bathtub, and I baptized her. And I never told her dad. And then once I did the first one, it was easy to do the second one. I said, you better tell your husband. You'd better tell your husband. So, please. Uh-oh.
Come on. Okay. One of the challenges when I'm working with young adults discerning ministry is the state of ministry on the other side of seminary, so the debt problem. Mm-hmm. But they're watching what the church is doing to young leaders, and it's not good. And so I'm in the Northwest Washington Synod, and in the last 2 months, we've lost 4 of our best leaders in congregations that tend to be run by your Back to Egypt committee. Mm-hmm. And they kind of just fall off the map. Mm-hmm. And I've been walking with one who kind of their sense of call was gone out mm-hmm. of that. And the church, in all expressions, are putting a lot of pressure on our young, talented, sold out for Jesus missional leaders, putting them into great context. But what can we do better to support these folks? And part of me wants to mourn those that that get chewed up by the church. Mm-hmm. And it impacts, I'm working with young adults who say, if that's what the church is gonna do to me with courageous leadership, I got better things to do with my life. So how can we all be better at doing that work together?
Well, that's true. I mean, we train these people who have missional hearts and send them to congregations which might not have missional hearts, and they come up against that. On the other hand, I think we might do a better job in seminary saying, don't start thinking you're going to go to a congregation and change everything that's happening there, even if what they're doing is wrong right now. I always told my people, when you go out there, you have to love Jesus and believe that you're called, because it is hard. And you've got to love your people, and there's great wisdom in the laity. Now, unfortunately, we do send folks right out of seminary to the places that might be able to, you know, only afford someone unmarried, no dependents, you know, bottom of the compensation guidelines, whatever. And right there, it's going to be a difficult situation, even with folks who are just, yeah, let's do this. Because a lot of times people feel like they're just on the edge of survival. And then when you get into that survival mentality, it's a lot of fear-driven kind of stuff. And you put someone with no experience there, that can be really tough. So one, I think we can, I often say that when I read some of these essays, that some people have read or watched To Sir With Love one too many times. I don't know if you know this movie. No, okay, we know this movie. It's an old Sidney Poitier movie. It's worth looking up. But anyways, it's about this teacher who comes and he's teaching in like the slums of London, and then, you know, you're doing good works. And that's, you know, we have this missional heart, but it's not going to be like that. The other thing is about Ken Enske, about whom I spoke before, who grew up in a fundamentalist evangelical household, discovered Lutheran theology. He says, people do this. They'll go online, they'll read about Luther, and then they go to one of our congregations. And so for all of us in congregations, if we're still a fear-driven church, worried that we're not going to survive in this building, in this place, in this way, you're not going to be very open to imaginative thinking or even welcoming somebody else from outside. So that's on us. Do we really believe the resurrection happened? Do we really believe in grace? And then slowly, if that can be nurtured or we can get to that point, then we might not be so tense all of the time. And then folks coming out of seminary, you know, we all have that zeal and we're going to change things. No, to love and respect your people. But there are some congregations that are just nasty. Just nasty. And my husband had a seminary professor said, don't be surprised when sinners behave like sinners. Or was that your mentor, honey? Who was that? Ed Steese, yeah. Who still hasn't graded our papers. He was notorious for being late during the meeting. Yeah. Oh, Dan Stevick, that's right, yeah. So that's going to be true. And so we try to put in place first call theological education. So that when you're for your first 3 years, is I don't know what we do for deacons, they're really out on their own, but for pastors. And we hope that will build a community so that you can then have these case studies about what you're going through in your congregation and have some community. Now, I think in your synod and my former synod, geographically, it was compact enough that people could get together. It's really tough. I think the toughest call right now is for an unmarried young woman to be assigned to a rural parish, say in Montana or Grand Canyon or Rocky Mountain or Southeast, because there's nobody around. And it's a wonderful call. It's a privilege to serve. There's joy in the gospel, but it can get really lonely sometimes. So how then do we as colleagues, and not just those coming out of seminary finding their own group, how do other colleagues keep an eye out for these folks? We had in a conference in my former synod, someone said, well, so-and-so never shows up to our conference meetings. I said, have you called her and said, we miss you and keep calling her? No, and we don't do a good job. And we're out there and we become Lone Rangers. So, well, that would be a Lutheran Shangri-La. So we'll change the church. We really will not be fear-based. We'll live as though the resurrection really happened. We'll be filled with grace. We'll have open imaginations, welcome folks, people right out of seminary. We'll be patient and learn from the lay people, and we'll all be together as a community. Oh, yeah. I think that... And it's 10 minutes... I gave you back 7 minutes of time that I lost yesterday. So thanks, everybody. It's been a great week. It's been really wonderful. Thank you.